Hello, everybody. You're listening to Aaron Torgelson Weber and Karen Hooper's review of Peter Jackson's Beatle documentary, Get Back. We hope you enjoy it. So welcome, Aaron. Long time no talk on a podcast.
Yeah, it's been a while. Yeah. So hopefully we'll be able to make this a habit again.
Yep, that's the plan. And everybody on our website was really anxious that we were back and anxious to hear us talk about the documentary that's been on the lips of just about everybody for 2 years. So I'm sure they're kind of anxious to hear what we think about it. And as we were talking before the podcast, we're kind of taking a different sort of approach to this because the movie's been out for a couple of years and everybody and their uncle has weighed in, and we're kind of taking a less structured approach to it, as you and I talked about. But mm-hmm. We are starting with just a really quick synopsis of, we used to start with the author's synopsis, but this isn't a book, so we'll start with the director, who's everybody knows is Peter Jackson. And people can Google him. He, you know, look up his bona fides, and he's, you know, made tons and tons of movies. He's very well known. And the point of interest here, though, is what made him create this documentary. And according to Wikipedia, he was visiting Apple Corporation to discuss work on a Beatles exhibition in virtual reality. And somehow the other, while he was there, he asked about the archival footage from the documentary from 1970 and was given access to the documentary, the footage. And apparently he said he was hesitant to sign on to the project because he was afraid about kind of revealing or getting into the sort of reported acrimony that was sort of evident or presented from 1970. And then he said upon reviewing the footage, he was relieved to discover that the reality, quote, was very different to the myth. And you and I talked, Aaron, before the podcast just briefly about how the feedback and the reviews of the documentary have been overwhelmingly positive in accepting of basically the narrative of the breakup wasn't as acrimonious as was first thought, et cetera, et cetera. So I'll turn it over to you.
So I was very late to the party in that I only finished watching the documentary 3 days ago for a number of reasons that I'm not going to get into here. I had to take a step back from Beatle mm-hmm. academia and Beatle studies for a while due mm-hmm. to family issues. So I did, however, read a lot of the reviews when Get Back first came out, and the analysis of certain Beatles authors and fans, magazines, etc. And I have to say that some of the reviews were excellent. All of them were very interesting. And really what interests me the most about this documentary is and has been the reaction in Beatles historiography, more so than the documentary itself. Because for me, when I first heard about this, that Jackson's work was coming out, my evaluation hasn't changed over the course of several years after having finally viewed the documentary. And that's, this is a secondary source. It is Jackson's interpretation mm-hmm. of the tapes.
Yeah.
And it is an interpretation that differs from certainly earlier interpretations. So we've had, with Jackson's work now, three major interpretations of the Get Back tapes. We have, what were you going to say, Karen?
Sure. I was going to say, you're including Sulpi in that? Sulpi et al?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
So we have Michael and Zia Hogg's obvious Get Back film, or Let It Be. mm-hmm. And that's released in, is it a few weeks after Paul has announced the breakup?
The release of Let It Be?
Right.
It was after the announcement, but I don't know how soon after. Yeah.
Close enough in proximity.
Yeah.
to the announcement, the public announcement of the breakup, that, and we'll get more in depth into this later on, it is viewed as a window as to why the Beatles broke up. People are going into Michael Lindsay Hogg's version knowing that the Beatles have broken up, and therefore are assessing the film inevitably. And this is not a flaw. It is simply the reality of how humans think, analyzing it, looking for evidence. Why did the Beatles break up? Because of that chronology, because of that context. So Michael Lindsay Hogg's version is inevitably seen in a lot of ways, particularly in the time period when it is first released, as a breakup film.
Yeah.
Then you go further along, and the second major interpretation we have is Sulpy and Schweikarts. I am not sure exactly how to pronounce his name. I'm going to go with, I believe,
Schweikart. Or something. Yeah, okay. We know who we mean.
Yes. Yeah. And that was published in 1997. And their version is, in a way, similar to Michael Lindsay Hogg's, in that it portrays the sessions negatively. So in that respect...
Mm-hmm. Can we just interject here, Erin, that is a book where they listened to, that they didn't have permission to even provide a transcript of the tapes. They just kind of listened to them and gave them sort of, they kind of conveyed what was in them. Like the book wasn't an actual transcript, yeah.
Because of copyright reasons,
yeah.
And this is the biggest weakness of the work, and there was nothing they could do about it, they had to paraphrase the tapes themselves. And so, again, it's a version of the Get Back / Let It Be sessions that portrays a band that is fraying, shall we say. And they are very blunt in their interpretation of some of the sessions. I can't remember exactly which session it is, but relatively early on, they're saying it's a wonder that the Beatles lasted past this particular session.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and for Michael, our readers, sorry, Erin, just for our readers, we did do a book review on Sulpy's work, if they wanted mm-hmm. to review that on the blog. Yeah.
So we have Michael Lindsay Hogg's version, which is predominantly negative. There are some lighthearted moments in it. But again, it's one that portrays a band that's undergoing a significant amount of friction and has fractures underneath the surface or above the surface in some cases. And then we have Sulpy and Schweikarts, which again depicts the sessions rather negatively. In the midst of this, and this is closer to Michael Lindsay Hogg's version, we have John in Lennon Remembers offering very negative accounts of the Get Back / Let It Be sessions. We have negative comments from other Beatles throughout the 70s, throughout the 80s, etc. And so now then we have Jackson's version. And Jackson's version is released in 2021. And in contrast to the previous two versions of the tapes, it offers a band that certainly is dealing with tensions, but I think it's safe to say offers a version of the Beatles that's more akin to the Fab Four narrative, certainly than the previous two interpretations of the Get Back sessions.
So Peter Jackson, excuse me, and I think it was a 60 Minutes interview. I have a quote here. And he said, as he was watching the tapes, he said, I was watching, waiting for it to, quote, get bad. I was waiting for the narrative that I believed over the years to start happening. I was waiting for the arguments, waiting for the discontent, waiting for the misery. And, you know, it didn't happen. I mean, it shows issues, it shows problems, but any band, any time has those problems. This is not a band that's breaking up.
Right.
End quote. Yeah, that's his view.
And that was one of the questions that I was left with almost immediately upon finishing the documentary, was, having finished this, if I did not know as much about Beatles history as I do, if I was a casual fan who this was my first real introduction, say,
project to the Get Back film. Sorry, you're going to have to edit this.
That was a phone call.
It's okay.
But to go back, if this was the first major interpretation I had of the Get Back sessions, I would finish this documentary wondering, why did this band break up? Mm-hmm. Because there are what I thought of as evidence of microfractures throughout Jackson's version of the tapes. Mm-hmm. You have George's discontent with his status in the band and with what he perceives as the lack of attention and appreciation going into his songs. You have Yoko's presence, which is something that Jackson gently lands on when he's having Paul discussing the difficulty of writing songs with John when Yoko is there.
Which was post the meeting at George's house, which didn't go well.
But certainly it's not something that Jackson drills into.
No, no.
And you have no acknowledgement that John is on drugs.
Mm, yeah.
So there are these microfractures, and microfractures can be healed if they are given time and attention. And that's the perception that you get from Jackson's version of events, that there are these microfractures. So having finished the documentary, my perception is that the implication is that it's Klein. Because Klein is not looming in the background, but you have those mentions of him. You have those discussions of him. And a knowledgeable Beatles fan is going to know that Klein comes into the picture more fully following these sessions, and those microfractures eventually become what Paul referred to as the crack in the Liberty Bell. And that's the crack that famously could not be mended.
Right. So the perception is that in spite of the original movie's kind of negativity and slant toward, you know, discontent, that it really isn't a movie about how the Beatles broke up. That really happened after.
Yes. And that would be a significant switch in interpretation from Michael Lindsay Hogg's version and from Sophie and Schweikhart's version.
Yeah. So potentially, because, well, you know, I remember reading, and I don't remember the source now, but when the breakup happened, when Paul filed, you know, that John was like, what's this all about? Like, he was surprised. And there was that conversation where he kind of said, like, he was just baffled by Paul's actions, which kind of supports that idea that, you know, they were like, sort of, they knew that there was tensions and they were kind of having to sort of reconstitute themselves, because it was, I mean, they've been together for how long, and they weren't sure of how, you know, John had an idea about each of them having equal songs on an album and to give George airplay, whatever. And where was I going with this? Yeah, so, but they were not breaking up. They didn't see that period as being, we're on the verge of breaking up. That may have been actors, you know, kind of influencing behind the scenes later.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I remember thinking also once I finished the documentary, and it was leading to that question, okay, why did this band break up? This version of the Get Back tapes would have been the sort of evidence that John, George, and Ringo and Klein could have submitted at the Beatles 1971 trial, saying, this is a band that isn't fundamentally broken beyond repair.
Right.
Because that was a significant part of their version of the court case.
Right.
Paul was arguing that there is no salvaging the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are too many differences, and Klein is the biggest one, whereas the other Beatles are arguing, we can salvage the Beatles, Paul just needs to bow to majority rule and accept mm-hmm. Klein as manager.
And it's interesting over the years that the narrative that was presented in the first 1970 movie, the Beatles themselves kind of started to internalize.
Yes.
They weren't saying that at the time, except for Paul. But in the years following, oh, yeah, that's the breakup movie. Like, they kind of, they joined that narrative themselves.
So, and this is spoiling the end in a way. And maybe I've said it before, but at the risk of repetition, I'll say it again. My evaluation of Jackson's work is, I do believe it has value. I am grateful for the way he cleaned up the visual mm-hmm. of the tapes. That yeah. is astonishing and stunning. Having said that, that can also lead to a difference in our perception. Because the original Get Back film is so grainy and dreary
yeah.
and just difficult in certain ways, visually. Mm-hmm. I think you could give us the exact same version of Get Back as Michael Lindsay Hogg's, frame for frame, edit for edit, but if you did it with Peter Jackson's visuals, where yeah. it's cleaned up and the colors are vibrant, there's a very good chance that you would have a different interpretation, a slightly more optimistic interpretation of the film simply based on the cleaned up visuals.
Well, you know, there's someone had done on YouTube, they had done, I don't know how they had access to the original movie, but they do. And they showed key scenes and comparing between the original and Jackson's. And in addition to the clean visuals, even the editing was vastly different too,
mm-hmm.
of the same interaction. So yeah, if you're going to get a different impression just because the visuals are nicer, can you imagine if the editing was different?
Right. But that's just human psychology. There's yeah. a reason why most people, our interior of our houses are painted, you know, white colors, neutral colors, light colors, instead of dark brown or black.
Yeah.
Those are colors that make us feel depressed. They make us feel gloomy.
Is there a view, or I don't even know, this is a view or a perception or a guess out there, that is that just a matter of the technology of the time, or is that sort of part of the what the movie was intended to project?
I can certainly be corrected on this. I think it was just because Michael Lindsay Hogg anticipated doing a television show.
Oh, and so right.
Shot with a certain quality and type of film. Oh, and then it turned out
yeah.
television show. And so therefore that made the film significantly worse as a movie.
Because the Beatles talked about that in Get Back.
Yes.
When they realized that it wouldn't be a television show, and they were discussing whether the film would be sort of corrupted in a sense if it was made, you know, reverted to a movie versus a, you know, a TV show or whatever. Yeah. Can I just read before you, what you're saying, Aaron, is just, we're talking about the interpretation. Of course, we have to defer to Mark Lewisohn because he weighed in on this. And a lot of people reviewing the movie deferred to Mark Lewisohn as the ultimate, you know, expert on whether this, the authenticity of the movie. Mm-hmm. And Lewisohn said, I guess in an email to, his name is Ben Lindbergh, and he is the senior editor of The Ringer, which is a sports and pop culture website. And he says in an email from Lewisohn, Lewisohn said, "No one knows everything about anything. Even in this instance, where I'd listened to close on 100 hours of the audio spools from the month, I knew that seeing the footage and Get Back was going to tell me a huge amount. If anything, I underestimated that. It's nothing less than the Beatles education primer, ultimately instructive to me and anyone else who really wants to see and hear who they were and how they worked. Get Back, the documentary, provides an immeasurable contribution to our understanding of what made the Beatles so remarkable." And he added that the movie was honest and maintained maximum integrity.
I think it absolutely makes a significant contribution. Mm-hmm. And I want to make that very clear. I am grateful that Jackson made the film.
Mm-hmm.
Where my issue is when this perception developed that it is a bulletproof new interpretation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
Lewison had, when he said, I listened to 100 hours of the audio spool. So we don't have that. We have the edited version of that.
So right.
He's in a better position to make up his own mind. Yeah.
And so that's where the issue lies for me. We do not have the primary source. So to get back into the issue, as we always do, of primary versus secondary source, Jackson's version is a secondary source, the same way Michael Lindsay Hogg's film is a secondary source, the same way Sulpian Schweikhart's version is a secondary source. They are filtered, they are edited, they are the tapes themselves are the primary source, but the films and or the book that we get based off of those tapes, those are secondary sources.
Mm-hmm. So, and Philip Norman, interestingly enough, in writing, I guess he writes for the Times, sort of made that point. He was apparently critical of the editing of the footage and the general tone. And he said that there were several, quote unquote, inconvenient facts that were excluded, including John's heroin addiction.
Yes. And,
yeah. And
that would absolutely be an element that is an omission that any knowledgeable Beatles fan is going to pick up on.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, with this, we talked before about including the conversation between Bill Maher, and who is an American comedian, and he makes social commentary on his show Real Time. And he has a podcast, and in the podcast in September, he interviewed or met with Julian Lennon. And I wanted to include that in this discussion because he commented on the impact of the he's a Beatle fan, obviously. And he commented on the impact of the movie. And one of the statements he made was he wasn't stoned and he didn't see any evidence of that, whatever. So I'm going to pause right now so we can include it and then we can talk about it after.
Sure.
As someone who is outside the circle, so you can get some information you can't possibly glean being so close to it, just as a fan, a young man in the 22nd row sees Marilyn something more than sexual. Not just our Marilyn Monroe, to me, okay, that guy in the 22nd row, this documentary was very affirming because how anyone could watch it for 9 hours.
Yeah. I mean, did that after the fact.
Okay, but I'm talking about the 9 hour one.
Is
the entire month of January. It's January 1969.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I don't know what happened before, I don't know what happened after, but I feel like I know where your father was in that month. Because there's a lot of footage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was, first of all, he and Paul McCartney are in love. Yoko, is she there all the time? Yes. He never even looks at her. He never talks to her. It's just like a potted plant.
Yeah.
He's in love with Paul McCartney. They're, of course, because, first of all, they're working.
Yeah.
So, but the whole thing is them, and he, your father, certainly not on drugs.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and happy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Happy to be there and working with his boys and his
The thing was, it reminded me of him, you know, when I saw him as a kid and how it was a fond recollection because it was him being himself and being mad and bonkers and smart and funny and creative It just reminded me of the great, the good things about him, because I'd lost a lot of that over the years, one way or the other. You know?
Yeah, I mean, and it is, you could look just like a love affair, and I'm not saying this there's a gay element here. They're just two guys who love each other.
I get it.
But you know, when people love each other, certainly man and woman, it's a lot of like inside jokes,
of course, yeah.
Right? And just looks. Paul and John are doing this to each other throughout the whole thing. Oh, yeah, yeah. They don't do it to the other two.
No.
And they are certainly,
they have to certainly have
they
their
own. Certainly don't do it to their girlfriend. Linda comes to a little bit, but it's like they're like they are just no, so it's, third
it's,
wheels.
It's their world. It was their world.
Okay, so comments.
What interests me about what he had to say is that it appears to be, again, the general perception of a lot of people who watched the documentary. And there are some factual errors in his interpretation, in Bill's interpretation. As we discussed, John is using heroin in the Get Back sessions. And I do see certainly
can I just, can I just interject? We even have proof where John's talking with when George is gone and they're just John's late and George sorry George is gone, John's late, Paul and Ringo are sitting around with the rest of the people discussing what they're going to do next, and in this John joins the group and they're talking and he mentions being quote stoned and high watching movies the previous night, and Paul says, is there any need to do this in public, Mr. Lennon? So even in the movie, John addresses his drug use. Paul comments on it, doesn't want it in the movie. But in the Bill Mark commentary, he just sort of missed that. Yeah.
Right. And sometimes it's easy to miss little moments, depending on how much attention you're paying to the documentary.
Yeah.
And he made that comment, obviously, about seeing the very obvious connection between John and Paul. And obviously that is a major element of Jackson's film. I do see moments like that among all four Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that would be something that would harken back to the Fab Four narrative. But his perception, his interpretation of Jackson's interpretation appears to be the popular response to Jackson's film.
Right. And as a fan, and I think the response that most of the critics had too, at least the sort of fan-based critics, not Philip Norman or people who've written about the Beatles, but generally those who just, you know, write for a popular culture magazine and just watch the movie and, you know, write an article about it.
And again, for me, it's just another interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's another interpretation of primary source evidence that we do not have available to us. We have parts of it available to us, but not all of it, not unedited. And so that is what would be ideal in this situation, in any situation where we've really only had three major versions, three major interpretations of this primary source evidence. One of them, again, is extremely influenced by its context because of when it was released following the news of the breakup. Another one agrees with certain aspects of Michael Lindsay Hogg's version, particularly how negative the sessions were. And then the third one pivots on certain issues, but also presents a more optimistic might not be the right word, but a more Fab Four friendly version, if you will, of the primary source evidence. The issue for me remains, in neither of those three interpretations do we actually have the primary source evidence, the unfiltered tapes, to compare and contrast to any of the interpretations.
Right. And one of the biggest kind of redefinition or revisionist narrative or different interpretation, whatever, however you look at it, is the view of Yoko and the impact, the dynamic of her being in the creative process or just being physically present. And I think almost, I've not read really maybe one, but most reviews, because the narrative always been she, quote, broke up the Beatles, blah, 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 that it was, you know, Yoko was just this, I think, what did Bill Maher refer to her as? She was like a sort of the house plant. Like she was so uninvolved and her presence there did not affect anything, which does not jive with even what Paul said in the actual Get Back documentary about having it it being difficult and awkward for him to create and compose or whatever when Yoko was there, because he feels this kind of need to impress her, or just having anybody kind of present when you're not used to that when you're creating. And George commented, I think, in the anthology that it was difficult with her there. So her, you know, her being physically present, there was that alone has an impact. And this Amanda, her name is Amanda Hess, and she wrote for the New York Times about the movie. And she said, I'm quoting her, the sublime spectacle of Yoko Ono disrupting the Beatles initially thinks, I thought to myself, her omnipresence in the documentary was bizarre, even unnerving. The vast set only emphasizes the ludicrousness of her proximity. Why is she there? I pleaded with my television set. But then in the article, she goes on to say that she almost saw Yoko's presence as a form of feminism, that the other women in the Beatles' lives were never present. They were kind of, you know, almost like part of the scenery. And it was like Yoko refused to leave. And by virtue of staying was kind of establishing her, you know, sort of proximity in John's life, which was a kind of an interesting take on that.
That's an interesting take. I think it might be a little too influenced by retrospection,
yeah,
considering that our understanding of why Yoko was there is because John wanted her there.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm putting sort of words or thoughts in Amanda Hess's mouth, but it was almost like, I think she was saying, anybody else would think, I'm not sticking around here. I'm going to go work. I'm an artist. I'm going to go somewhere else and do what I do. But she stayed, and she's I think assuming that Yoko stayed deliberately as a sort of an act of feminism or something. Yeah. Which is, yeah, kind of an interesting take. I don't believe that myself. I don't see it that way, but that was her take.
Well, and that's probably one of the areas where you have the most significant difference in the interpretation between Soapy and Schweikart and Peter Jackson.
Yes.
Soapy and Schweikart's interpretation of Yoko's presence is that it was negative, it was detrimental to the band's unity, it was corrosive in terms of what her influence, artistic, personal, otherwise, was doing in regards to John's relationship with Paul, John's relationship with the other Beatles. It was, according to Soapy and Schweikart, a significant reason for why George left the sessions, mm-hmm, and why the meeting went so badly when they were trying to convince George to come back after George left.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Jackson portrays Yoko's presence, a houseplant, as Bill Moyer joked,
mm-hmm,
would be more descriptive. I remember writing in my notes, Heather is more disruptive in her one day that she's at the sessions,
mm-hmm,
than Yoko is when Yoko is there for an entire month of sessions, with the obvious caveat, Heather is five.
Yeah.
she's doing what any five-year-old would do. I have, mm-hmm, a five-year-old right now, and I'm watching Heather go to sessions, well, crawling on the floor.
And that's interesting, yes, Aaron, because there was another article. I don't even have all the reviews here, but I remember reading one where there was the perception that, you know, well, geez, Linda was there with Heather, and people were focusing so heavily on Yoko. You know, fair enough. But I don't get this sense that Linda was there every single day sitting beside Paul and instructing him, however subtly, creatively. You know, she was kind of there with her daughter, however often, I don't know. But it was hard. It's really not fair to compare the influence or the sort of whataboutism didn't seem appropriate and accurate.
I just found Heather's cameo amusing, completely amusing. How she interacted with all of them, all of, mm-hmm, the Beatles, and just again, her behavior was classic five-year-old. But yeah, absolutely, she was disruptive to the sessions,
mm-hmm,
in a way that Yoko sitting next to John is not disruptive, mm-hmm, at least on that same obvious level.
I wonder, and I don't even have, if there's even an answer to this, but I wonder if Linda, I mean, at one point, Patty showed up and Maureen was there when they were on the roof. So the women were kind of coming into the sessions, and it was seemed to be, from what I've ever read, kind of, it never happened, that the partners and wives and everybody, nobody was around. And I wonder if, I don't know, like I'm just, Yoko's presence sort of opened the door for, okay, well, if this is permitted, then I'm going to, you know, I think Patty just stopped it to talk to George or something. She didn't stick around. But I'm just wondering if you could see that kind of, you know, when one member starts doing something that's a little bit different, then it allows space for the other members to do it too. Or maybe it's more of an act of defiance. Okay, you're going to bring her. I'm going to bring my, wife in, or my girlfriend in, or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to remember exactly where we were before we got on the subject of Heather and
well, we were Yoko. talking about the sort of key differences in the narratives, and one being, is this a breakup movie or not, and this the perception of Yoko and her influence were the sort of two key changes, between
what you get from, again, Silpi and Schweikart, which would chronologically be the previous major interpretation of the Get Back tapes, as opposed to Peter Jackson's. To dig into that a little further, I was talking with one of my best friends, and I've known her since we were 12, and she's a casual Beatles fan. I think my book is the only Beatles book she's actually read, and she read it because I wrote it. She's seen A Hard Day's Night probably 5 or 6 times. She knows a lot of the Beatles music, and she actually watched Get Back over a year before I did. So I was asking her the other week, when I'd gotten through about half of the documentary, I said, what is your perception based on Jackson's film as to why George left the sessions? And she said, because his songs weren't getting enough attention from John and Paul, and he didn't want to wait until he had to release them on a solo album. He wanted the attention, and he wanted the focus on his songs that John and Paul were giving one another.
Well, rather than George, Paul was bossy, which it tends to be.
Or that there were tensions caused by Yoko's presence in the studio.
Yeah.
Because we have parts of the flower pot conversation that are edited where they're discussing the meeting that did. Or you have why George left, which again, that's an issue the exact specifics of are cloudy.
Yeah.
Believe the current prevailing interpretation is that John and George had a disagreement. You have some claims, although it's never been verified, that this disagreement turned physical, and George left.
Yeah, and that was sort of borne out in, at least in Sulpi's transcripts, and even a little bit in the actual Get Back documentary, where they're talking about that later, you know, when they, and there was, I think there was not a voiceover, but there was the sort of print over of the movie that was sort of summarizing, they went off to a meeting, it didn't go well, whatever. And yet over the years, the view was Yoko / Paul were the reasons that he left. Yeah.
And I believe that's reinforced by George. I think it's in the trial testimony and potentially in anthology.
Yeah.
As well. That's still the version of events we're getting, despite contradictory evidence.
Well, it just strikes me, Aaron, that probably it's not one thing or the other. It's probably a number of everything. It's a combination of everything. He's more, you know, he wants to spread his wings. He's been in the sort of Lennon-McCartney sort of machine, you know, creative machine, his whole creative life. And there's no room for him in this arrangement. And plus this, plus Yoko's there, plus, you know, plus. And he just kind of like, you know, he topped up.
Absolutely. So, yeah. But the version that we get in Jackson is John and Paul are connecting with each other, working with one another, however you want to put it, and at a level that they are not devoting to George.
Right. Yeah.
And that is why he leaves. That's the only version George leaves, according to Jackson's film.
According to Jackson's version, right. Yeah.
And that's the problem, because we have other evidence that indicates that other factors entered into George's decision to leave and his frustration with the meeting that followed. But none of those other elements are incorporated. So you have, at best, an incomplete version of why George Harrison left the sessions.
It's just, as we talk, it's so interesting. And at the time the movie came out, and my first reaction was that it's the latest narrative, and it kind of supports what people want to believe. And it's positive, and it's kind of like, oh, I'm going to pick this one because it kind of jives with what I already think or what I want to believe. And there wasn't really a lot of critical analysis of The Get Back, other than saying Michael Lindsay Hogg screwed up. There was never sort of an objective analysis of the two data sources. It was always, you know, stated subtly, but it was like the first one was kind of incorrect, and this is the correct one.
Right. And again, that's why the best method, which will presumably never happen, which is a shame, is if Apple would just give us the tapes.
Yeah,
give us the tapes, give us the primary sources, release them, and let fans filter through the tapes and compare and contrast them with the differing versions we have gotten. Because so far we've got Michael Lindsay Hogg's version, which is, again, more negative than positive, and is always going to be identified as a breakup film or an explanation of the breakup because of when it was released, even though that's not the reason why it was filmed.
Correct. Yeah.
And that's something that obviously has to be taken into account. Michael Lindsay Hogg wanted to do this television special, and he spends a lot of the documentary trying to emphasize the visual and the spectacle and wanting that payoff at the end of the documentary. He did not set out to document the breakup of the Beatles. And that absolutely needs to be taken into account by everyone who is watching his film and everyone who is watching Jackson's film. Michael Lindsay Hogg didn't set out to do that. That wasn't his agenda. But because his film comes out in close proximity following Paul's announcement that the band is breaking up, that's inevitably how it is interpreted. So you have that version of events that is reinforced by Lennon Remembers, that is reinforced by interviews throughout the 1970s, throughout the 1980s, into the 1990s, and it's a very negatively slanted one. Then we have Soapy and Schweikhart's version, which is also one that primarily depicts the sessions as fraught and stressful and negative, while also emphasizing the role played by Yoko Ono in that negativity and in that stress, and also emphasizing, crucially, John Lennon's heroin use and how that played in to the negativity.
Yes.
So then we have that, and then we go decades and decades until we get to Jackson's version. Jackson's version is obviously a cheerier version, I think it's safe to say, than either Michael Lindsay Hogg's or Soapy and Schweikhart's, but it also omits primary source evidence. It sidesteps issues, while at the same time, yes, it provides us a window into the working relationship of the Beatles, and in particular, the focus on John and Paul that is certainly portrayed more positively in Jackson's film than it is in Soapy and Schweikhart, or that it is in Michael Lindsay Hogg. And in a way, it slips back to the Fab Four narrative.
Yeah. Well, Giles Martin, I have another quote here. He said of the Get Back documentary, my impression of it is that Paul and John kind of knew they were growing apart. And the movie was kind of like a marriage that showed a marriage failing and them wanting to go back on their date nights again. Like he saw it as them trying to, you know, kind of knowing there was sort of writing on the wall and not knowing kind of where it would end up, but trying to hang together rather than pulling apart.
That's an interesting interpretation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. Just Peter Jackson, this is not a band that's breaking up. Giles Martin, they're trying to go back on their, you know, date nights together, trying to kind of reestablish a connection. Bill Maher's comments, like, and when I watched the movie personally, it was nice to see, like, Paul and John, like, they didn't really look at, there were moments between, you know, kind of casual moments between, say, John and Ringo and goofing around with George and whatever, but in the work process, they were eyeball, like, they really are eyeball to eyeball. You know, they George was sitting kind of behind John and Ringo's on his drums and Paul and John are the two. And that was so apparent to me to watch. It wasn't just something that we've heard other people say they worked eyeball to eyeball. They were still working eyeball to eyeball even then, as late as 1969.
One of my regrets is that we don't have a documentary like this or tapes like this from, let's say, 1964 and then again in 1966.
Well, you've got auditory. You've got auditory outtakes. Like, you've got just the, you don't have like visuals, but you've got, you know, them recording and they're all over YouTube. And primarily, well, you don't hear from Ringo. He's on the drums and he's kind of set back, but you're hearing Paul and John all the time.
Well, like, I just mean something on this scale.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Of the amount of tapes, the amount of footage, the amount of auditory. We don't have something on that scale for, let's say, 1964 or 1966. And then to be able to compare and contrast them and see what's changed, what had changed.
Yeah. And all we've got are the sort of outtakes. And we've got, well, we have, you know, George Martin's view. People, George Martin and I can't think of... Jeffrey Emmerich is his name, but just the people who were there, the sound engineers and George Martin commenting on the work relationship. But you also have, I was just remembering in 1966 where they're working on Revolver, that things were really tense then. So they had tense moments. So yeah, we've got anecdotal anecdotal information and views of other people, but yeah, we haven't seen them. You don't have tape of them actually making an album together.
Right. So I just keep going back with Jackson's version. The issue for me upon finishing it is the question that came to my mind after I finished it. Why did this band break up? Because one of the questions you're supposed to ask yourself, you look at the evidence, you analyze, and it's not just enough to know what happened. You have to say why.
Mm-hmm. And that's a question that in reading all the reviews of the documentary, I've not seen articulated ever. It's like this landmark movie and it rewrites the narrative and blah, 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 blah. But I've not read, maybe somebody has and they can bring it to my attention, but I've not read one article, one review that had that question. Had ever sort of articulated that question.
But one of the other interesting elements of this to me was, to get into more detail, it was that issue of Klein entering into the picture towards the end of the sessions. Mm-hmm. And how for people who are familiar with Beatles historiography what that signifies. Because again, the implication for me is, according to Jackson's interpretation, yes, there were issues, yes, there were tensions, yes, there were microfractures, but these were issues, these were microfractures that could have been fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you don't get is what happens next, which is Klein coming into the picture and presumably, according to the prevailing interpretation, ensuring that those microfractures don't get fixed.
And there's that moment in the movie where you want to say, oh God, run, John, where he's in the recording booth with, is he talking to Glenn Johns, I think? And he's talking about Alan Klein and his upcoming meeting. And he says, he knows me. I think George was there. He knows me as well as George does. And he's all excited about, and you want to say, run for your life. like, please. You want to jump through the screen. Yeah, so it's an interesting inclusion, I thought, on Jackson's part to have that in.
And there's another fascinating comment, and this one is from Ringo. And the reason that I picked up on this is because Ringo says almost the exact same thing in his David Vedder interview from 1971 in Playboy, where when John is talking about how amazing Klein is to Glenn Johns, Johns keeps describing Klein as very clever, but also very strange. And strange in as his perception, his ability to persuade people, his ability to get people to do what he wants them to do. And Johns is saying this, John is talking to Glenn Johns and describing Klein about being so incredible and being a hustler. Mm-hmm. And Ringo responds, well, he's a con man who's on our side for a change.
Yes. Yeah. I remember that quote.
And that's almost exactly what Ringo says in the David Vedder interview, where they're talking about why they like Klein so much. And Ringo says something to the effect of, well, he might be a gangster, but he's a gangster for us.
Yeah.
So it's interesting in a way because it makes you wonder what evidence could be presented to the other Beatles to discourage them from life.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you say, well, he's a hustler, he's a con man, and again, that some of that evidence, not all of the evidence that we have now, but some of that evidence did exist in 1969.
Well, and the Stones,
but let me finish.
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
But that is perceived as a strength by the other Beatles. Ringo is saying, yeah, he's a con man, but he's our con. Goes back to, I can't remember what American general it is who's talking about Cold War dictators that the United States props up in the 1960s, 1970s, and the Cold War. Well, he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch. So what you have is basically Ringo saying, well, yeah, he's a con man, he's a scoundrel, he's a gangster, but everybody in the music industry is a con man or a scoundrel or a gangster, which is an implicit argument that Brian Epstein was not, but this one is ours. So we have to have a con man of our own in order to match forces against everybody else in the music industry. So you might have had Paul coming to meetings talking about how much of a gangster and con man Klein was. All that's doing is burnishing his credentials for John, George, and Ringo.
What I was going to add was that, but Paul, I think, also had the view of the Stones, who had dealt with Klein and didn't like his gangster approach. Mm-hmm. So right. While, you know, I don't know the conversation obviously between Paul and the others, but it's yeah, obviously to say, well, he's a gangster, they're like, yay. But it's like, well, wait a minute. Here are people that we know,
mm-hmm,
that didn't like, the gangster wasn't so yay.
Right.
You know, so I don't know if that information got conveyed to them. I would have thought it would or should, whether it was known or not. But yeah, they definitely, the gangster the gangsterness of Klein, it was seen as a positive. But there is so much evidence that that wasn't a positive, really, you know, for other artists. And whether or not they understood that or heard that, I don't know.
And I think that is the issue where John, George, and Ringo wanted a gangster for a manager.
Mm-hmm.
But what they got is someone who was not necessarily primarily interested in representing them to the best of his ability.
Yeah, it's an odd view that they had. Like, yeah, he's a gangster on our side. That's just weird. Like, it, you know, it just seems that, you know, it can backfire on you. That, like, it's just an odd, I don't know why they had that sort of need. And I know that they kind of thought that Brian was a gentleman and had integrity, but I think they thought he blew a lot of possible deals for them, or they lost money, blah, blah, blah. And maybe at that time they were really worried about money and, you know, kind of worried about their financial kind of future, although they were millionaires. But there seems to be a worry that they had, certainly when they opened Apple, and the money, according to John, pouring out like hand over fist. They wanted somebody, like some mafia figure, to come in and straighten it out in their favor. I don't know.
Well, there is a joke where George and Paul make a joke about the Apple boutique, at least, or some elements of Apple going under.
Yeah.
Because George Martin is talking about opening his studio, and George Harrison and Paul make jokes about essentially wishing it to do better than Apple had.
Yeah, the Apple boutique. Because they gave everything, they closed it and they gave everything away.
Right. So they're not oblivious
yeah.
to what's going on the business side of things. But I just thought that issue of Klein in the background is such an interesting one, again, because we see John from the very beginning enamored with Klein, focused on how well Klein knows him.
Yeah.
Telling George Harrison, whom he has known since George was a teenager and who has known him, that Klein, after one meeting, knows him just as well as George Harrison does.
So incredibly naive. That's what strikes me the most, I think, is how naive it is.
Mm-hmm. And having Ringo saying, well, he's a gangster, but the music industry is full of gangsters and con men, and at least he would be a gangster and a con man on our side.
And I think that it seems to me Klein had done a really lucrative sort of royalty deal for the Stones.
Yes.
And being worried about money, that's what they wanted. That was what John was really focused on, as well as I think Klein was sort of courting Yoko and saying, you know, we need to bring you to the forefront and promote your career and all that.
Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to think, hit all the major categories on this.
Just to recap. So we have, in terms of bringing up Klein, we're kind of saying that that era and the movie, the original movie being portrayed as the breakup movie, really wasn't one. It was really the influence of Klein subsequently, and how that sort of rewrote the sort of narrative that the movie presented, and even in the Beatles' own minds, that it was Klein's influence and all that was going on around that time because of him.
You're talking about Jackson's version?
Well, I'm talking about the original that was seen as the breakup movie, but really wasn't intended to be that. And, you know, the Beatles themselves didn't say at that time that they were thinking, except for Paul, breaking up. And I'm talking about why it became the breakup movie after the fact, I guess. And that was because that Klein was kind of insinuated in their professional life.
Well, my perception is that Number one, the reason it's associated, Michael Lindsay Hogg's version, as the breakup movie is because of its proximity to the actual breakup. But what it shows in the original breakup version, in the original Michael Lindsay Hogg version, is more the focus on the band's tensions, the interpersonal issues and relations.
Okay, so it's a bit of both, like, yeah. Okay.
And then it's not until you get to Jackson, to simplify, if you want to identify one reason for the breakup, I'm trying to think of a better way to phrase this. My perception is that the first film, Michael Lindsay Hogg's film, puts more blame for the breakup, if you want to filter it that way, on the band's interpersonal relations.
Yes, I agree.
And Jackson's film does not do that. Instead, with Jackson, you're left to draw your own conclusions from what you know of Beale's history. And that conclusion, the next step would be the Beatles broke up not necessarily because of interpersonal relations, although that was a factor, but primarily because of Alan Klein. So it's shifting the blame from more of a...
Do you think that Jackson's... I mean, that was sort of implied, but you think that was sort of an intent? Does it seem like it was sort of a deliberate sort of shift of a narrative or not?
What I find curious about Jackson's film is the omission of well-known evidence.
Sorry, I didn't catch that. The omission of...
The omission of well-known evidence.
Oh, yeah.
That knowledgeable Beatles fans are going to very quickly perceive this was edited, we left this out, that sentence in the flower pot conversation wasn't included.
Yeah.
And so I have to draw the conclusion that this was not intended for, it was intended for the widest possible audience.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes sense.
And we have to add too that Paul and Ringo and Olivia and Yoko were co-producers. I mean, nothing happened without their sort of say so. So I don't know to what extent his efforts reflected that in terms of, I doubt he would want to provide or make a movie where it had more negativity in it about people than it, you know, I kind of wonder about the influence of that. He didn't make it independently, you know.
He has to get there okay, even just to use the materials.
Yeah.
We don't know how much of a finger or hand they had in the actual editing process, what he chose to include, what he didn't choose to include.
And he said that they had, like, he's gone on record by saying, you know, I just did what I did, kind of a thing.
Right.
So, like, in other words, it wasn't with an eye to impress or not piss off his co-producers. Yeah.
At the same time, certainly my impression has been for the last however many decades, particularly probably following anthology, that it is preferential for every side in Beatles history, with the obvious glaring exception of Alan Klein, to place the blame for the breakup on Klein. Because that relieves the Beatles themselves and their various camps from being blamed for it. And for a variety of other reasons. There's obviously a significant amount of evidence indicating that Klein did play a major role in the breakup.
Yeah. So your takeaway, aside from all that we've talked about, Aaron, just as a, do you have any other takeaways as far as just generally how you felt watching the film? Like, I personally, I felt a little bit of what Julian was saying in that interview with Bill Maher, where you kind of got reacquainted with the sort of funny, silly John that you always saw previous. Like, his personality so often in that period is just sort of like so mercurial and negative and weird. And you sort of felt you saw the human again, you know, and the interplay between band members and the joking around and stuff. I think that, to me, I'm really glad that was in there, because as a Beatle fan of some age, I remember that from before, and it was nice to see it was still there. Although I still had questions about the missing stuff, and that kind of bothered me. And I have to say, right from the beginning, I kind of had a bit of a mini stroke when the movie had introduced the year Paul and John met as 1956, when it was the following year. Mm. So right away it was like, wait a minute, you haven't got your facts straight. But anyhow, aside from the questions and the kind of why is this missing and why did this get portrayed in this way in this context, and I like the fact that Mike McCartney was in there, because you know I like Mike McCartney. So my overall feeling of the movie was I enjoyed it with all the questions that we outlined in our podcast.
I did enjoy it, and I'm glad Jackson made it. And I think visually it's stunning what he was able to do with the material he had.
Yeah.
I think in a lot of ways it reflected back to the Fab Four narrative for me. And I've always believed the validity in that narrative, particularly in the depiction and the portrayal of their friendship, of the Fab Four's friendship, and how unified they were.
Mm-hmm.
I do think watching George in the documentary, there's an obituary of George, and I can't remember exactly who it is, but the description has always stayed with me, and it's something to the effect of, even in the Beatles days, you could sense feeling his exclusion from the white hot center of the Beatles where the two geniuses held court.
Yeah, yeah.
And certainly that is the impression that you get, or at least that I got, mm-hmm. watching this version of Get Back and Let It Be, is that George Harrison senses his exclusion from that center. And that promotes a certain element of empathy, certainly from me, towards George. That even when you have these conversations with John and Paul in the Flower Pot conversation, they are acknowledging how they need to change their approach towards George. And in a lot of instances, don't even mean to marginalize or diminish. He's perceiving it that way,
yeah,
because that's his expectation now.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the history among the three of them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
That's certainly a significant element of it for me, is the role. One of the things that was very striking for me is how little of a role the other George plays. And I know
he was
that
just George hanging out. Yeah. George Martin was just sort of hanging out. Yeah.
Yes, I know that, yeah. George Martin was obviously not as involved in these sessions as he was in virtually every single other Beatles album, but I always go into every source thinking, how would this influence my perception of the Beatles if this were the first major source on the Beatles I watched or read? And if this was the first major documentary you had ever watched about the Beatles, your perception on George Martin would have been that he was a relatively insignificant figure.
You mean overall? That was the only movie you ever saw?
Yes. If this was your first introduction, if you did not know that much about Beatles history or historiography, and this was the first documentary you ever really watched on the film, then you very well would come away with the impression that George Martin was not that influential.
Well, what was his role there? Like, I was kind of... He kind of sometimes would lend moral... He was kind of like a big brother in his... His comments were kind of supportive and, you know, providing context, whatever. But I really wondered why he was even there, quite honestly. Like, he wasn't producing, was he?
No, that was Glyn Johns.
So why was he there, I wonder?
There are certain moments where Martin is there, and it almost seems as if his purpose was built in the room.
Yeah, he just was kind of interjecting himself in moments of conflict or try to sort of preempt any conflict but he didn't have a practical role.
Well, there's a great moment towards the end where they're talking about doing the concert on Thursday. And George Martin makes the comment and says, you need to schedule it before Thursday, because if you schedule it for Thursday, it will not be done on Thursday.
Yeah.
He knew their patterns. He knew their habits. He knew their delaying tactics. And he doesn't say it sarcastically either. He doesn't say it wryly.
He's like the dad.
He just is very matter of fact. If you schedule it for Thursday, it will not get done on Thursday. So schedule it before Thursday. Yeah.
So I wonder if he was there on his own accord just because he wanted to see what was going on. Like, in other words, he didn't have an official role.
I think he did have an official role, I believe he had abdicated a great deal of that to Glyn, of the actual working on it to Glyn Johns.
That's something I'd like to look into more, because that puzzled me, that he was just, So you have Michael Lindsay Hogg doing the movie, you have Glyn Johns sort of producing what, the musical side of it with George Martin in conjunction, or, like, it's just really confusing.
Again, they wanted it to be unvarnished, and they wanted it without what would generally have been George Martin's traditional production.
Yeah, his fingerprint wouldn't be on that,
Yes, so his fingerprints are significantly less evident on this album than really any other Beatles album, and the perception is that's why he took a significant step back. He's still credited, I'm not sure exactly whether it's producer, executive producer, into that. But Glyn Johns is doing much of the active work, and Martin is still present in a lot of situations, but not nearly as hands-on, certainly, as he would be at Abbey Road.
Yeah. Well, God knows the movie gave us lots to talk about. I'm glad it wasn't sort of replica of what Michael Lindsay Hogg did, because that would just be boring. But I think before the movie was released, all of the promotion for it was really heading this way. You're going to be pleasantly surprised. It's going to be wonderful. It'll be affirming of, let's throw the flowers and hearts and kisses. It would just be not what the antithesis of what the first one was. And I think that was true.
There's a reason that the Fab Four narrative was so popular, and part of it is because there's a significant amount of validity to it, but because it gives us this intense friendship that helps create the music.
Yes. Yeah.
And the music is what we love and what drew in a lot of people in the first place. So when you're further distanced from the breakup and the acrimony of the breakup, then there's a lot of important elements to Jackson's version. You have these, again, very heartwarming moments and demonstrations of the musical alchemy among the four of them, and of John and Paul working together, of John and George working together, of there are moments where you can almost see it click.
Yeah. Well, that brings me, that totally, as you're talking, I was just thinking, what I liked about the movie, which I didn't say before, but what really struck me was that it was exculpatory of Paul. People, and just in terms of reading people's comments, they just grew up believing that Paul was bossy and Paul was this, Paul was that. And what they saw was someone trying to keep, in his own way, using his own methods, to keep this band together. Because he was seeing the splintering. And the other thing was that people seemed to be absolutely in awe of when he composed Get Back. So there was a different view of Paul that I think the official narrative had always sort of presented, or what people believed. Even my sister was really not a big Beatles fan, but she kind of thought that about Paul. When she watched Get Back, she said, I didn't realize. She had this view of him that was shaped by, the previous how many decades, and it gave her a different view of him, and his behavior with the other Beatles that she didn't have before.
Well, and that corroborates with Sylvie and Schweckhart.
Yes.
Because Sylvie and Schweckhart, one of the major arguments that they make of their interpretation is that blaming the tensions in the Let It Be sessions on Paul's bossiness is unfair. Mm-hmm. And
incorrect.
And incorrect.
Yeah.
Right. Their argument is that it's been significantly overblown, again, in Michael Lindsay Hogg's version, in the interviews that followed, in the breakup era narrative. Mm-hmm. And so in that respect, even though Sylvie and Schweckhart's version of the Get Back sessions is significantly more negative than Jackson's version, mm-hmm. they both concur on that particular element. Was it an issue in some areas? There's evidence to indicate that for George, certainly at some times it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or you have John talking about how sometimes he wouldn't speak up on how he wanted his songs produced.
Yeah.
Because Paul would just do what Paul wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, yes, it was an element, but to make it the most important element, which it can be perceived as being the most important element in Michael Lindsay Hogg's version, mm-hmm. you have two subsequent interpretations of the primary source material saying, was it an element? Yes. Was it the most important element? Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm. And is it more a function of personality and how that shapes creative, your approach to a creative endeavor versus, you know, a sort of a bad personality flaw, you know, because right. these people are creating and they're going to approach that endeavor differently. Mm-hmm. And we've had this discussions lots of times on the blog that Paul's going to approach it in a way that's was very different from George. And they really acknowledged that.
Yes.
And during the Get Back, well, even in the Let It Be documentary. Yeah. But somehow that became nefarious over time.
Well, and that's one of the interesting things too, is how self-aware they are.
Mm-hmm.
They're aware of how they're treating George. They're aware of the contrast in how they create and how they produce.
Yeah.
And you can see them trying to figure out how to deal with these issues.
Mm-hmm. And probably a lot of people, or you know, a certain segment of the population, they don't have any experience working in a team in a creative endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their jobs take them, like they're more, they're just not this, it's not the same process. And that kind of clash, those kind of clashes will happen.
Right.
There's not a creative group that doesn't happen to. But the average right. person watching is thinking, oh man, you know, that mm-hmm. guy's right, that guy's wrong, he's bossy,
right.
he's whatever, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But we could talk about this for another couple of hours, Aaron. It's an endless source of discussion. So do we have anything else to say before we wrap up our discussion about the Get Back documentary? Final thoughts?
To Debbie, the secretary at Apple, who did her best to stall the police.
Exactly.
I was so impressed.
Wasn't she the one, too, that brought in the coffee, was juggling that huge tray of coffee?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, she was awesome.
Yes. Yeah. She and Mal, they were doing the best they could to stall. Yeah. And she's saying, oh, I can't find this person. And they're just recording a new album and just doing everything, anything and everything she could do about making sure that they got to record or they got to play as long as possible on the roof. Shout out to her.
Yeah, total shout out to her, yeah. And the police finally came up, but it was kind of almost over, so I guess they kind of decided mm-hmm. it wasn't worth their effort. But yeah, I hope she got a raise.
I hope so, too.
Okay, so I think we're going to wrap up. I don't have any final, my only final comment was about the year the John and Paul met was wrong. That really bothered me. And I want him to, in previous, you know, if he releases it again in different editions, like a book, he needs to change that because that really bugged me. Other than that, I said what I came here to say.
And my final thought would be, and I know this isn't going to happen, it would be, my final comment was to Apple, I don't believe this will happen. Just release the stinking tapes. Let us have the primary source material and analyze it ourselves and use it to evaluate the accuracy of Michael Lindsay Hogg's version and Sylvian Schweikhart's version and now Peter Jackson's version.
It would be a good, you know, kind of a graduate student's research project.
Absolutely.
Yeah. If they don't want to release it to the public. Yeah.
But it's still one of the issues that you have to delve into with primary sources is how many people have been able to access these sources, and therefore how many different interpretations do we have of them? And obviously the fewer interpretations you have of them, the more power is concentrated in fewer hands.
Yeah.
So the version of the Get Back sessions we had until Sylvian Schweikhart, so that's almost 30 years, was a singular version. It was Michael Lindsay Hogg's / the breakup version. And that's part of why it became so cemented, is because we had one version. Then we were given two versions, and now we have three versions. But that's still not that many. And it's still filtered, it's still edited, it's still translated, however you want to put it. So again, my appeal to Apple, and I'm sure nobody is going to hear this who actually has any sway, is just give us the tapes already.
Yeah. And until then, we're going to have Get Back, I think, it's become the official narrative, 100%. And he's going to do more work, I think, too. He's got some other project, which I can't remember what it is. Peter Jackson, that is. So he's becoming the new Mark Lewison.
Maybe in terms of reach, in that I don't know what the viewership was for this version of Get Back. I imagine more people watched it than have read TuneIn. Just going by the ubiquitousness of television.
As opposed
to reading books. And so that's certainly an element that plays into the influence of a source, is how many people see it, how many people view it, how many people read it. And I certainly think you could make the strong case that this has been viewed more than Michael Lindsay Hogg's version, and certainly than Sylvian Schweikhart's. Yeah.
But I wonder, though, I should say that I wonder if people would perceive the movie as almost like it has a life unto its own. It's not like it's attributed to Peter Jackson's Beatle expertise the same way that, say, Mark Lewison and his writings are. It's almost like Peter Jackson gave us this gift from the vaults, you know, versus Mark Lewison, who is considered, you know, an expert researcher and all that. But yeah, but the two of them are kind of, they're the top rung for sure.
And it'll be interesting to see what comes out in the future.
Okay, Erin. So we'll just wrap things up and conclude the podcast in our review of the Get Back documentary.
All right. Sounds good.
Sounds good. We'll talk later. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please visit us at our blog at www.beetlebioreview.wordpress.com.